Hey everyone, Cave Dan here for the Faithless Brewing Podcast, home to the spiciest decks in the modern format. On today's episode, we begin with our testing results with Watcher for Tomorrow, a creature that offers powerful card selection if you can make it die. After that, we dive into our first installment on the fundamentals of brewing. How can you become a better deck builder? All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to Faithless Brewing, episode 15. I am David Robertson in the Twin Cities, joined in the Twin Cities by Dan Schriever. Dan, what's going on?
Hey, what's up, Dave? Yeah, I am not that far from you, just a short drive away. A little bit of homecoming this week, visiting my parents and enjoying everything the cities have to offer. It's gorgeous.
Were you coming back into town for the GP specifically and choosing to visit your parents at that time, or a happy coincidence, or what's the story?
Well, it depends on who's asking, I guess. No, I'm here to spend quality time with the folks. Oh, there's GP. What are the chances?
And joining us, as always, is Damon Alexander, who was in Minnesota, is now in Seattle, but is coming back to Minnesota. Is that correct, Damon?
That is absolutely correct. I get on a flight tomorrow to Minnesota, where I will be staying approximately 50 feet from Dan. He was my next-door neighbor growing up, and so it's always fun being in town together.
And joining us this week, extra special guest, Rhett. He was a high school friend of mine. Rhett, what's going on?
Hey, not too much. Going pretty good. Yeah, so we've known each other for a long time now, many, many years.
What do you think, seventh grade maybe?
Yep, seventh grade. That's the time. Lots of old connections built around the magic tables over lunch. And then I know Dan through your younger brother, which is another interesting connection. First introduced us, and we used to do drafts at Dan's house when we were young in high school, and that's where I met Damon as well, who was Dan's neighbor.
Yeah, so this is a bit of a homecoming episode of sorts. If listeners out there wonder why we always talk about Minneapolis, even though I live in Connecticut and Damon lives in Seattle, it's a large part of our hearts. When I think of Magic, I think of this core group. I feel like I've known you guys forever.
That's because we're old, man.
It literally has been forever.
Since I'm slightly older than you, Damon, for all I know, I was there when you were born.
Yeah. We have not checked with Damon's mother, but we will wait for Snopes to get to the bottom of that claim.
The story seems to check out, though.
Yeah.
I mean, we all went to St. Paul Central, so yeah, represent.
And for people who aren't from here, I mean, the Twin Cities are generally interchangeable if you're not from Minnesota. So St. Paul, Minneapolis. Technically, Red and Dan are not in Minneapolis right now, but the safe Tony suburbs of Minneapolis.
St. Paul is not a suburb of Minneapolis.
First of all, St. Paul is a suburb of Minneapolis. Second of all, Red and Dan are not even in St. Paul.
I'm sitting in Rhett's house right now in St. Louis Park.
Oh, got it.
Man, I didn't know we were dropping some Minnesota bombs here. Oh, Lord. St. Paul, suburb of Minneapolis. Here we go.
This is heating up.
This is all stuff people need to know. If you're coming into town for the GP, you don't want to embarrass yourself and stay in St. Paul for the Minneapolis GP.
Ooh, my goodness.
So last week we discussed a bunch of Watcher Tomorrow, or is it Watcher for Tomorrow?
Watcher for Tomorrow.
Watcher for Tomorrow, Bruce. We were sort of proposing playing him in a banned Blink Shell, and I think that type of list kind of blew up a little bit. A few people were sort of inspired by Nassif's General Shell. I think a few other people were inspired by that 5-0 list. Damon, do you want to break down kind of some of the choices you made? You know, I think there's a few decision points when you're constructing this list and sort of your impressions of the deck in general, or if there's ways to improve, or maybe things you didn't like about the shell that you chose to play.
Yeah, so I basically started with Nassif's list, which was very similar to our list, but the main difference being no Aether Vials. Last week, I was like, I don't like Aether Vial in a deck with this few creatures. You guys disagreed with me. And rather than fight it out there, I decided to just not play them. Ha ha ha. But yeah, so this deck plays basically 12 2-drops that all cantrip in different forms. We have Coiling Oracle, Ice Fang Coadal is 4-ofs, and then 2 Wall of Blossoms and 2 Watcher for Tomorrows. And then it goes into value cards like Deputy of Detention, Three Eternal Witness, a Lone Flicker Wisp, a Knight of Autumn, a Mull Drifter. And then the interesting thing is Four Soul Herder, which is a Modern Horizons uncommon that was a draft superstar. One blue white for a 1/1 spirit with some super spooky art. And it reads that whenever creature is exiled from the battlefield, you get a +1/+1 counter on it. At the beginning of your end step, you can exile another creature you control and then return it back to you. And so as a result, one of the things this deck can do is get Soul Herder going and at the very least flicker a Wall of Blossoms to draw a card. One step better, flicker a Watcher for Tomorrow and get a free kind of lagged impulse effect. Flicker Eternal Witness to give back anything. Flicker Knight of Autumn or Mull Drifter, which can frequently just lead to a really good situation against a lot of different decks. It feels kind of like a Planeswalker in that sense where it just generates incremental value every turn. And then the deck can go big with Soul Herder, Blinking Eternal Witness with Time Warp, which gives you infinite Time Warps, and that lets you win the game. And then there's a couple Jaces, and there's four Ephemerates, which is an interesting card. I wish I had drawn it more. I didn't draw it too often, but it's another Modern Horizons card that lets you flicker a creature for one white at instant speed, and then it has rebound, so you get to do it again. And so this lets you, in the kind of fail cases, you can just flicker a Coiling Oracle, and then during your upkeep, flicker it again, and they get two cards for a single white mana, which is actually like a ton of value. And with Coiling Oracle, it even can like double ramp you in theory. And there's some paths and some Force of Negations and a Familiar's Ruse to round it out with a nice kind of Snow, Prismatic Vista, Bant mana base. Yeah, so I took it through a league and I went 3-2. The losses were to Hogak, so who does that even count? Like, I don't know exactly.
Which version of Hogak were they? Just out of curiosity.
The one that casts Hogak on turn two every game.
yes.
Not the Dredge Hogak list, though. It's...
No, it was just the regular Hogak Vine.
Yeah.
Game three, actually, what happened is that it was kind of strange to see the game go this way, but I had a Rest in Peace, and they killed me with just, like, 1/1s. And this deck actually features a ton of, like, Wall of Blossoms and Coiling Oracles, and you think I could assemble some, like, nice 1/1 blockers to trade and go up a card. But I just, like, I didn't, and I just died. I ran out of stuff. It was a strange game that I lost, the way that went. The other loss was to Infect. So basically this deck, like, the feeling I have is it takes a while to get the ball rolling, because you're leading on turn two with, like, Coiling Oracle is like your best play. And this is like the turn where like Hardened Scales decks are going nuts with Mox Opal. This is the turn where Hogak's going nuts with just everything. And we're here, you know, playing a nice little value one drop. And then even from there, it takes a few more turns to really start grinding together. And so like seeing as like the way you can really win against the decks that have super powerful things is your powerful thing is this Soul Herder Witness Time Warp lock is like your cleanest way to win a game. That just takes a while to develop. In the meantime, like any sort of disruption on your relatively fragile Soul Herder and Eternal Witnesses can kind of mess things up. And so like Infect just ran over me before I could get anything going. Four paths was not enough. But then I had three wins against a Bug Wilderness Reclamation deck. I think actually in two of the games I assembled the Time Warp lock. In the third game it was actually pretty sweet because before I got the Time Warp lock going, I got a Soul Herder Eternal Witness like Dovin's Veto going. The only reason the game went so long is they drew four remands in the top like 20 cards of their deck to delay things a little bit, but every single turn I would go up a card off the Dovin's Veto being returned. And then I beat interesting like Lantern Mystic Forge deck, like Lantern Control plus Mystic Forge to combo win.
Uh-oh, Dan.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was interesting. So game one, I think I won because I had a Force of Negation for their Lantern piece, and I beat them down with Coiling Oracle beats. Game two, I got the Soul Herder Knight of Autumn value engine going, and their deck almost landed his combo, but it was just that was just too much for it. And then I won a game against a match against Jeskai Tempo, which was not a modern staple, but think of just like a Jeskai list featuring Spell Quellers and Brineborn Cutthroat.
Blue Tarmogoyf.
Yeah. It was a cool list the guy played. It had a lot of disruption, and as a result, the match was a very interesting, close game. I think that I won game three with like us each having like a minute left on our clocks.
So you've answered some of my questions just through your match reports. I didn't get a chance to watch any of your matches, unfortunately. But as we were proposing these decks last week, I was thinking like that Time Warp thing will surely never come up. And some of these Soul Herder Eternal Witness loops, they just sound kind of cute. They sound like fun kitchen table casual stuff, and I honestly did not expect you to ever assemble them. So I'm kind of surprised that you did. I mean, you said you got the Time Warp thing going, what, one match out of the five, which is not insignificant.
I think I got actually going a few times beyond that, so maybe like four times total in the league.
That's pretty good, actually.
It comes up more often than you think, just because the deck features so many creatures that draw a card that even with two copies of Time Warp, you tend to find one of them. And then Time Warp is actually, honestly, I think there maybe should be more of them. It's a pretty good card in the deck. You know, its fail case is like a land drop and a draw. And then if you have a Soul Herder or a Jace, it just gets you like a lot of incremental value. One thing I found tricky with this deck, this is actually maybe where the Aether Vials would have been super helpful, is that to go from like sort of nothing into Time Warp lock requires a total of, is it 8 mana? Or is it 8 mana and a Soul Herder on the battlefield? Because you play the Time Warp, and then in the next turn, you can go up to 8 mana, and you play Eternal Witness, and then Time Warp. And then the next turn, you can go Soul Herder. No, yeah, you run out doing this. Yeah, so you really actually kind of need to get a little bit of extra mana going in a way that Aether Vial would support to get the Eternal Witness and the Soul Herder on the battlefield very early without needing the whole 8 mana or leaving yourself open to disruption if they get a turn to untap and kill your Eternal Witness or Soul Herder. Because Soul Herder is actually by far the best removal target in this deck. So that's actually one of the downsides. And so unless you have Ephemera ready to protect it, them dying is just kind of sad.
Well, that was my second question / observation was when you were describing taking some time to get going, like the turn 2 Coiling Oracle being kind of sad, I was thinking like, yeah, it sure would be great if you already had something that you played on turn 1, like, I don't know, like an artifact that could just get a counter every turn and add mana throughout the course of the game. Not that anyone thought of playing cards like those.
Wait, sorry, which Arkham's Astrolabe? Which card?
Oh god. Jeez. These modern times we live in. I don't know. I still stand by that this deck should play Aether Vial. I understand what you're saying about it not having enough creatures, but that maybe just indicates that we should add more creatures.
I mean, the problem is that like there just aren't that many spells. I could see maybe cutting the Jaces, but having a little bit of counter magic seems important. And then the four paths are just important to be able to survive until turn 3 or 4. And then, honestly, Ephemerate was just really good. I like that card. I wish I drew it more. Every game, I just kind of wish I drew Ephemerate. It's the only reason, by the way, that Watcher for Tomorrow is at all playable in the deck. Watcher for Tomorrow is, like, tough. It's just tough to use it. As we discussed, Tomorrow Never Dies. And so you play it, and then you're like, I don't know when it's going to leave the battlefield. If you have, like, a Soul Herder at the ready, then yes, it will leave the battlefield soon. But if you don't, then you're waiting for literally your Ephemerate to unlock the card.
Were you ever able to kill the Watcher in combat?
No, of course not. Of course not.
He is indestructible, essentially.
Yeah. And he ETBs tapped, which is unfortunate because you can't even like block with him immediately. And so usually whenever I had him, I always had to like face these tough decisions of which card to pick because I wasn't sure when he would die. And so as a result, I was not super impressed with the card, unfortunately. I think that the Jeskai Saheeli list we had that played the card was much better suited to bouncing it with more sources that did that, with Teferi and
Felidar Guardian.
And Felidar Guardian.
Saheeli, and then
yeah.
It did have paths, lightning bolts, and lightning helixes that often you just wanted to point at something. So might as well point them at Watcher for Tomorrow.
Yeah.
But I think another reason why the card was better in that shell was because it was pretty clear in that deck sometimes that the combo pieces were just worth more than everything else. So if you're not sure, you can always just stash one of your combo pieces under the Watcher. That will be worth something whenever you get it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, when you have a deck that only two cards matter and you're trying to put them together, then Watcher's impulse ability compensates for the fact that you have to play all these other wacky cards to get access to the impulse itself. In this deck, it's like a slightly better effect of Wall of Blossoms, but not being able to block for huge chunks of the game is like a really big problem.
And literally just like not getting the card immediately.
Yes.
The fact that you just draw the card means that you can use Well of Blossoms to help hit land drops, for example. And Watcher trying to hit land drops is just miserable.
That's interesting. So he's better at digging for high value pieces.
Yeah, and the cards here are so close to interchangeable. Like Time Warp has a unique effect, but some of these other cards are just another value card. I mean, when you put like another Well of Blossoms under Watcher, it's just... The games in Modern just don't play out that way where you're just trying to like make it through a bunch of removal. It's rare that they do.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you play the Watcher for Tomorrow on turn 2, then the best case scenario is you'll have Ephemerate on turn 3. And then like any other situation leads you not having access to the card until like probably turn 4 at the earliest. So it's like not a good card to help you stabilize in the very early game. It's just a little bit too slow at that job.
That's valuable information. A bit disheartening, because I do like the card a lot, but I understand why that is the case. I hate when you guys describe it.
I'm not sure on this. I mean, I think it's worth, if you're going to try the list out, keep trying the Watcher. I mean, it is strong with Soul Herder, for sure.
So let me just ask then about Soul Herder, because that's the card you were probably mentioning the most out of everything in the list. I guess it ended up being a Soul Herder deck. Would that be fair to say? What's your assessment of that card right now in this kind of shell?
Yeah, it felt like one of the kind of like the key cards of the deck, where every game you really want to find a Soul Herder, because that's really the card that gives this deck a step up in power from playing a bunch of like 1/1s the cantrip into actually developing so much value that you can steamroll and take over a game. The only card that really gets you there is either like some Muldrift or Femrate line, which is possible and sweet, and I pulled it off once, but I think it was the turn before it's dying anyway. But yeah, Soul Herder is really what kind of holds it together and takes the deck's power level up a notch. And again, even Soul Herder plus Eternal Witness, getting back anything from Path to Exile to Ephemerate all the way up to Time Warper, they're all really good. And then couple that with the sideboard cards, and I like Soul Herder a lot, except for the fact that, yeah, it's very fragile at the start. It gets out of Bolt Rage pretty fast, but usually not fast enough.
Yeah, that was something that, Dave, you had been talking about last week, the size of the Soul Herder starting at 1-1, but growing potentially very quickly if you can surprise them with something like an Ephemerate or a Path to Exile. What is the soonest that a Soul Herder ever becomes a 4-4?
Well, it depends on the cards that you're playing in your list. You know, Ephemerate and Path both add to it. I was playing Restoration Angel, so if you target Restoration Angel with Soul Herder and Resto bounces something else, then you get two counters on that first end step, which is a very cool interaction. Blinking a Eternal Witness and that end step ephemerating that Eternal Witness also adds two counters quite quickly.
So there's lots of ways to get it into still Bolt range very quickly.
Yeah. I have not played against that many decks that have played Bolt, but it has died to Fatal Push many times.
Yeah. It does at least survive Renin 6. That's like the one upside.
Yes.
You do have to have a creature to exile first. So like if you go turn to Coiling Oracle, they go turn to Renin 6, kill your Oracle, then your turn 3 Soul Herder is going to be pretty weak.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I think so many lists have moved towards 12 2-drops is because you need to have something in play for Soul Herder to be like playable. Playing it as a 3-mana 1-1 is obviously way below the acceptable mana curve. Like the fail case is really poor, so.
So I guess what I'm hearing from you guys is that the strengths of the deck are these creature synergies, the 2-drops and then the 3-drops. But then, Damon, you're also saying that you feel like the spells are necessary. You need Paths to interact and just give you something to stay alive. You need the Ephemerates to pay you off for having all these ETB effects. So does that mean that we're not able to look to some of the cards that I might otherwise go to in a creature-based deck? Like Collected Company seems like it would be great for finding two of these creature synergy pieces. Aether Vial, great for adding mana. We already fought that one out. But do you feel like there's like a minimum number of spells that the deck has to have? What's the right ratio? You identify those Jaces as sort of like just sort of hanging out in the deck.
Yeah, the Jaces I think came from Nassif, who is just a guy who loves Jace, which is reasonable. But yeah, like the slots are pretty tight in the sense that you really do need a critical mass of these creatures. And then your support spells, there's only, you know, 13 spells plus the two Jaces. And between four Ephemerate, which are like your kind of B half of an AB, not AB like combo, but AB synergy. And then you want a couple Time Warps to give you this nice win con. And then, yeah, you could maybe cut the counter spells in favor of something else. I'm not convinced that Coco is really where you want to be.
Well, certainly not if you have to have play that many spells. But
yeah, I mean, also Coco is just sort of awkward with Soul Herder. Like, you Coco main phase?
Yes. Well, because they have a Teferi in play, I assume. So,
oh, of course. So
of course, we're doing everything in main phase because that's magic now.
So I tried a bunch of like different variants. So I tried a list with like four Aether Vial. And when you're playing Aether Vial, then Familiar's Ruse gets better. So I was playing like multiple Familiar Ruse, kind of like the first 5-0 deck that sort of inspired the list. And when you're playing Aether Vial, Flicker Wisp is much better. Flicker Wisp is obviously not very good without Aether Vial, I don't think. Then I played a list that had like three Utopia Sprawl, one Noble Hierarch. So you had more stuff to do on one. And the problem comes from both of those shells, when you like have your better draws, are better than this version of the deck, but you tend to like run out of value a lot more often because you are playing so many more mana sources. You know, this list that Damon described only has 22 lands. If you start playing more lands to kind of be a little more explosive and not have your first drop be on two, you run the risk of flooding out because now you've got 26 mana sources or whatever in your deck. Or if you're playing 21 lands and four Aether Vial, you do start to run out of value sometimes.
Yeah, the deck strikes a weird balance between flood and screw every game. With only 22 lands, you really do want to hit every land drop because you want to be start double spelling because your spells give you so much momentum casting them that you want to be able to cast, you know, like Coiling Oracle into Soul Herder in the same turn, which requires 5 lands. So you want to hit every land drop, and with only 22 lands, well, on the one hand, you actually have all these cards that put you up a card. So you do see a lot of your deck in a hurry. But still, a 22-land deck doesn't always do that. And then, conversely, you play all these cards that can spin through your deck, but then you just hit land clumps, and then you lose the value engine. So it was interesting, like, striking that balance in this deck. It was, I think, like, 22 lands is, like, about the right number, but it's close.
Dave, were you trying Noble Hierarch in any of your builds?
I tried Noble Hierarch as, like, my fourth one-drop. So I played 3 Utopia Sprawl, 1 Noble Hierarch. Rhett and I had actually, before I proposed this list last week, talked about maybe just, you know, sort of using the, like, Arbor Elf Utopia Sprawl package in a list to try to play some kind of Blink Shell. And so I kicked that around and ultimately ended up with what I proposed last week. But I think, Rhett, you and I were even talking about going bigger, like playing, like, Thragtusks, and I ended up playing a couple Restoration Angels, but...
Yeah, I have a silly love for the Thragtusk Resto interaction in every format that's ever been legal in, so that is definitely in character.
The problem I found with Noble Hierarch is you're already just so soft to Wrath effects and removal, like you have an extra mana source that just dies everything, so that's why I was trying to play Utopia Sprawl as kind of an interesting way around that. The fact that you can only enchant forests is a real cost, so building your mana base gets a little more challenging and knowing like when to fetch. I definitely got burned on like certain colors that were picked. But yeah, I probably went like over the course of 3 leagues and with various shells, you know, like 3-2, 2-3, 3-2, something like that. So basically 500, the mythical every deck is 3-2 that Damon talks about in Modern. We have seen some people 5-0, you know, with Nassif's exact shell. I don't know that he himself ever has. I do think that the list is a little below Modern power level is kind of the sense I got. It is a little clunky. When you finally kick everything into gear, it isn't that powerful compared to some of the other things you can do. And basically every deck can interact with you because everything can kill a 1-1 creature. And that's kind of the main gist of being able to do stuff against this deck.
I don't think it's like so far off Modern's power level that like, if this list sounds appealing to anybody, I think they should try it for a league. I don't think it's going to like, you know, embarrass you as you burn your ticks.
No, absolutely. I think you could expect to reasonably go 3-2 a high percentage of the time. And the games you win are super fun. You set up these cool locks. If you are playing multiple familiars ruses, you can set up a familiar ruse lock relatively easily. There's a lot of clicks if you want to like take all the turns with Ephemerate and Eternal Witness and Time Warp. A few of my opponents who definitely made me like play out all the turns. And I am not the fastest clicker on MTGO, which I do not care for. And I nearly lost matches that on paper you would have won for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing is that, like, Devoted Druid combo, the combo to get a really big ballista, is just very laborious, right? You're just, like, clicking, 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 clicking. Winning with a Time Warp loop is, like, every single turn, the canvas is whatever you want. You can do anything you want in the game of Magic on that turn. And if they're not going to concede, and you just get to, like, you know, Soul Herder flicker your, you know, Coiling Oracle to draw another card because you have extra Time Warps at this point, you know, feel free. Wait until your Soul Herder becomes 25-25 and kill them with a giant, spooky Soul Herder. And so it's actually kind of fun to have a Time Warp combo. It hasn't gotten old for me yet, at least.
This is the most efficient Magic you can play when you are taking all the turns in your game of Magic.
Yeah, and unlike the stupid Nexus of Fate decks, this is actually like nice and like deterministic at that point. And so they could concede if they wanted to.
Yeah, they're just waiting to make sure you like you have to target the Ephemerate with your E-Witness the second time it's cast, otherwise the combo's broken.
Yeah, to be fair, I did actually screw it up one turn where I like should have gotten the lock complete and I just like didn't. I think I thought I had an extra turn lined up, and I didn't. I was very confused.
So let me just rewind on that note, because you're talking about Ephemerate and Eternal Witness as being a combo. So the reason that works is because, the Ephemerate doesn't get exiled. Is that right? It ends up in the graveyard or in your hand?
Ephemerate, Time Warp, Eternal Witness, and 6 mana, as long as you can make 2 blue, is all the turns. Because the first Ephemerate targets Eternal Witness, which gets back Time Warp. And then the next turn, Ephemerate targets Eternal Witness, and the spell resolves before E-Witness's target is on the stack, so it gets to target that Ephemerate again. Then you Time Warp target yourself and Ephemerate Eternal Witness and get back the Time Warp. So I've never actually set up the loop with Soul Herder, but I have set it up with Ephemerate and Eternal Witness multiple times.
You know, I never set that loop up, but maybe it's because I didn't know about it. Why didn't you tell us about that last week?
I did. I certainly mentioned this. There were two different loops. I found that loop to be much cleaner, and I think Ephemerate's actually like an insanely powerful card. If you have to play the rest of these like mediocre cards in the list, maybe it's... I don't know. The fact that people are 5-0-ing is very encouraging, but playing it, I kind of got the sense that Damon did too. Like, the deck is super fun. It's a blast to play, but there's a bunch of clunky draws, and, you know, I mean, if Hogak's going to stay legal, I mean, it just got absolutely blown out of the water in every league at least once. Like, you just don't get to play Magic, so, like, Ephemerating a Muldrifter is great, but, man, taking 40 damage the next turn really makes you wish you could have to cast all those cards you got to put in your hand.
I do agree that, yeah, Ephemerate, I think, is a surprisingly powerful card in this sort of deck.
Yeah, that was actually one of the feedback that we got from Reddit user RN on our last week's episode. You just said... Ephemerate is the truth. Whatever you guys do, Ephemerate is going to be your MVP. That was the prophecy that he made, and it sounds like that has come to fruition. So maybe Ephemerate, more so than Watcher or even Soul Herder, is, well, I don't know, I'm not ready to give a verdict on it yet, but like I always say, I'm looking for cards that are sort of best in class at what they do, and I've played plenty of decks with actual Cloud Shift in them. Ephemerate is two of that for the same cost. So... yeah, maybe we need to be paying more attention to this card and figuring out what it can do. I mean, I think that the shells you're describing is probably the natural home for it, but yeah, it sounds pretty impressive.
Yeah, I have a casual deck that features like black-white, like blink, probably featuring three Cloud Shift, and then I looked at this new card and it's like, wait, what? These Cloud Shifts just go to the trash can now.
Yeah. So the deck sounds like a blast, honestly, but... we're talking about the deck. I guess our card, Watcher for Tomorrow, do we have any final thoughts on that? How are we feeling about it, its performance in this list or overall?
I mean, to me, I started with three, I think, in the list I proposed. After playing with the list, I went down to two with two Wall of Blossoms. And honestly, the Wall of Blossoms was almost always just better. In theory, Watcher Tomorrow, you know, helps you search for the right card at the right time. But like Damon says... it's just so slow, you know, okay, it can help you find your graveyard hate against whatever, but by then they've already done something with their graveyard, so yeah. Every time you blink it with Soul Herder or Ephemerate, then it comes back into play tap, so it never gets to attack or block. It is just really clunky. The Hideaway ability, putting it into play tapped, is like a huge downgrade to this card, to the point that I almost would want to like cut another one, you know, and play three Walls of Blossoms. If you wanted to play your 12 two-drops, or it's maybe the easiest card to cut and not play any of them. So that was my sense. If you're finding a card that wins the game, then Impulse is a powerful ability. If you're finding another, you know, Eternal Witness or something, Modern is not, unfortunately, it's not about those kind of interactions right now.
I need to spend a little more time getting to know Watcher for Tomorrow. I'm not out on it yet. I do think that it's not an Impulse. It's like this weird delayed Impulse. And your ability to pick the best card out of four, subject to not knowing when you're going to get the card, is just a lot harder. And you'll make worse choices as a result, which makes it not as good.
I will have to accept these verdicts. I had hope for more from the card. I do still think it is a solid inclusion, specifically in the Jeskai Saheeli deck. But I think you guys are discovering some of the limitations of... yeah, a card like this trying to make the jump from solid draft pick to a Modern staple. It's a steep hill to climb.
Well, and just playing like a value list already in Modern, I think is kind of a big ask, as we've discovered in various weeks when we tried to build not necessarily shell similar lists, but shells that sort of are trying to make value plays and gain incremental advantage. And so when you have something that does that with a very real downside, as Damon and I are describing... that's even worse. So you have to play all these cards that blink it to make it even do anything, and so those cards aren't useful unless you have something in play, so it creates a lot of locked-in, cascading deck-building decisions. And
word. Okay, well, I think that is a good place to leave Watcher for Tomorrow for today, at least. Who knows tomorrow? Maybe we'll find something else to say about it. We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back with some thoughts on brewing. We are back. So we're not doing a brew session this week for a couple of reasons. One is that we have GP Minneapolis this weekend, and we're going to be playing a lot of Magic for that specifically. So we want to focus our attentions on that. But second, because we have this very special opportunity to have sort of the gang all together with Rhett joining us, I thought this would be a perfect opportunity to sort of get into some of the nitty-gritty, the fundamentals of brewing, if you will. The reason that I think this is such a great opportunity is that Dave and Rhett, the two of you probably brew more decks of Magic across all formats than anyone I know. I guess sort of the origin stories of this podcast is that Dave used to just sort of send us a proliferation of deck lists at all times via email. I would receive some of them, Rhett would receive some of them. And I was like, you know, these are great. We should share these. We should just talk about them. You guys, when you play, you each have like a duffel bag full of decks. You're just some of the most prolific brewers. It kind of is one of the things that I hear the most from listeners is that they will say something like, love listening to the cast. I'm not much of a brewer myself, but it's fun to hear you guys talk about decks. Even you, Damon, sometimes say you're not much of a brewer. So it kind of raised the question for me of like, well, what does it mean to be a brewer? Or like, what are the skills that make someone a brewer? How do you guys do it? And I thought this would be a perfect opportunity to just sort of pick your brains a little bit about your process, the brewing process, if you will. So I thought maybe I would just put some questions to you guys. Damon, feel free to jump in, of course, as well, and see where this goes. So I want to just start with the basics. Like, where do you start when you're building a deck? Like, what is the genesis of a deck? Is it a single card? Is it a synergy package, a combination of cards you're trying to explore? Do you start with looking at the metagame and seeing how you can attack it? How does a deck start?
Rhett, I'll let you go first.
All right. So, I mean, there's a couple divergent paths just at the beginning of that question. The first, it depends what I'm building the deck for. So I do play casual in addition to competitive. And so the formula is very different between those two. I will say that I am a brewer who usually starts with a card or set of cards I want to exploit. And I'm usually starting with trying to find unique takes on interactions. So trying to find ways to, you know, break cards or break symmetries. Because I find that personally intriguing in sort of like a Sudoku puzzle solving kind of fashion. And so a lot of times where I'm just sort of sitting around, you know, waxing poetically about the universe, like I'll think about these specific cards or interactions and just as like a mind game or mind puzzle, just try and figure out ways to break them. So I think that it probably usually starts with cards for me. The caveat to that is for specifically competitive brewing, I can also start with commonalities in the metagame. Sometimes metagames tend to kind of shift to a point where a lot of the decks are trying to do the same things. And I think that does open up interesting sort of like attack vectors on formats. And so starting decks out that I think would be good against like a whole slew of other things in the metagame is also interesting. And so that is the one case where I kind of get away from like the card or synergy oriented brewing and get more into like a bit more metagame oriented brewing when I see like specific things like that, commonalities in the metagame that are exploitable.
Do you have any examples of that off the top of your head?
I think the most obvious examples kind of go back to the old school archetypes of like true control and a beatdown and other things like that, where if a lot of the decks are trying to do one type of thing, it can encourage you to kind of like counter strategy against that. The easiest way I see it in today's metagame is I feel like there's been some proliferation of creature-based decks in the metagame right now. And so strategies that can specifically take advantage of the fact that your opponents are generally casting creatures are really good. And it's like one of the things you can aim for is just like figure out what specific cards are undervalued with the assumption that your opponents will always have slews of creatures lying around.
Yeah, that has been something that we have been talking about as a metagame trend. Dave, you were saying that these pushed planeswalkers are in turn pushing everyone to play to the battlefield sooner. It's kind of surprising because Modern hadn't been about that for a while. I guess hearing you say that, I'm wondering now if we should be playing something that exploits creatures more.
But I mean, isn't that one of the reasons why your Niv-Mizzet list is so good? Is because everyone is playing creatures and you're playing a 5-mana card that finds a bunch of 2-mana kill a creature effects, more or less, obviously, where I'm simplifying a great deal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a large reason why the deck keeps winning against the field. I check in on the Niv-Mizzet Discord, and people are getting very, very good results with the deck. And yeah, I think it's exactly what you said. You know, I talked about last week how the deck is doing great whenever it can trade its cards for the opponent's cards, and for a long time in Modern, it wasn't true that you could trade your Abrupt Decays for something useful, or your Lightning Helixes for something useful, but now you can. Tracking the metagame is a crucial component, like Red is saying, to making a brew sort of competitive instead of just sort of a cool puzzle for a card. So Dave, where do you sit on this? Where do you start?
I typically find myself inspired by a specific card, and I guess I can't say why a card ever intrigues or doesn't intrigue me, but what I typically try to imagine is like a series of opening lines that stack up reasonably well with like the default power level of whatever format I'm in. So I can imagine playing, you know, turn one, turn two, turn three, let's assume it's goldfishing against nothing, and my deck does the thing that I want it to do. What is the outcome of that, and how many different permutations can I make so it's reasonably repeatable? And then is that final outcome, like, at a reasonable power level against the quote-unquote, you know, tier 1 or tier 1-2 of a format? In this case, we're always talking about Modern. That kind of leads you to, like, interesting puzzles, because the card typically that inspires you is something new, right? It does something that cards before haven't. That means you can't find your sort of rule of eight, which Damon has talked about at various points, where you want eight cards that perform the same function. Unless this card is sometimes, because they do have to sell cards, maybe a little bit better version of an old card. You know, so we got new ninjas that could come down at two mana. Now you can play your functional eight ninja of the deep hours. Or maybe you get, you know, a better two mana cantrip guy. You know, you're adding Wall of Blossoms and Coiling Oracle and Ice Fang Quaddle. So now your blink effects are better, something like that.
Now, this rule of eight, I think we shouldn't gloss over that, because this phrase has been around for a while. I think it still tends to hold true. Damon, can you just sort of spell out how you see that rule working?
Yeah, the way I view it is that if your deck has like a really kind of critical interaction that powers it, that you just kind of can't get enough of or want to make sure you have access to every game, even through removal, you really want to have around eight copies or so, or maybe more. And especially if it's like a true AB combo, you really want to have that many. And this can kind of be like virtual copies in front, like the form of tutors. But yeah, so for example, in the Ninja of the Deep Hours type stuff, if you want to have the critical card being getting this turn two ninja, that means you might want to have at least eight one drops that you can ninjutsu. And then in this case, you'd have four Ninja of the Deep Hours and four Ingenious Infiltrator to really maximize the chances without going too overboard that you have a turn one, like Fairy Seer into turn two, guy that draws you cards.
So with only Ninja of the Deep Powers, you only have access to four copies of that effect, so you can't really be a deck that is counting on doing that. But when you have access to eight copies, you can start to do what Dave is saying, like imagining the opening sequence where potentially every game you can say, I'm only going to keep hands that execute the plan because I have enough.
Yeah, because like the thing is that if you only have four Ninja of the Deep Hours, like how deep do you want to go on one drops? Like, can you can play maybe like the good one drops, but some of the kind of more fringe one drops like Fairy Seer, which is really only shines if you can replay it for multiple scries, that card just becomes better if you can sort of rely on having your ninjutsu effect. And so because you get the first eight, that helps you enable a second eight in this case.
So Rhett, do you actually follow this rule when you're brewing?
Not explicitly. So it depends. I do like to have a certain set of copies, and then there are things that I count as fractional copies. So like you think of like a Serum Visions or a Ponder or something like that. It's not like a true copy of your main combo providing like true redundancy, but I count them as fractional copies. And I do like to get, if I'm hard comboing, I like more than eight copies even, but that's including fractional copies. So something like six hard copies and six additional fractional copies. And I think one of the better examples for this going back for me is actually if you look at the old Splinter Twin decks and look how many like fractional copies they played with like all of their filtering.
Right. They only played like four Splinter Twin, one Kiki Jiki, and then maybe like four of the 1/4 and like one or two Pester Mites. But with all their filtering, they had access to either half of the copy very, very frequently.
That's such an interesting example because of the existence of these cards like Kiki-Jiki or Pestermite that are worse than the primary copy of that effect, but like still sort of plausible, arriving at the correct number, you kind of have to feel out, like, how do you really feel about Kiki-Jiki or Pestermite? You know you like the Cvrx arc, you know you like Splinter Twin.
But then you saw like the way the format moved, so people weren't playing Bolt that much because they knew it wasn't good against Splinter Twin. So you're actually safe to play some of those other effects because, for instance, Kiki-Jiki's effect can't be redirected by Spellskite. That interaction came up a lot when Splinter Twin was the best deck in the format. But that's when you start going like levels on levels deep. You know, oftentimes, because Modern's so broad, it tends to not get so incestuous in some of those interactions where the decks become inbred to, you know, have slight advantages against each other. Maybe an example is when all these pros were playing Leyline main deck because they determined that their plan A was so powerful, they just had to make sure they weren't losing to the mirror copies plan A.
I want to go back then to something that both Rhett and Dave identified, or both of you guys said in your response. You both used the word puzzle, solving the puzzle, like a Sudoku, as Rhett said. Why do you use that word? Does that mean that you're trying to identify constraints around the card, or are you talking about more like the format constraints in the deck, or are you talking about specifically what this idea, the seed of the idea, what it needs to be a deck?
Well, it's funny, when we started saying, all right, each week we're going to try to come up with like multiple brews for Modern, I was really worried because the format is so powerful and linear. It's like, can you really, sure, every deck in 3-2, as Damon says, but can you really find cards that people aren't commonly playing and output them? But what Rhett and I have discussed quite a bit is Modern kind of asks, well, I'm talking about real Modern, not this Hogak Modern. So Modern asks you to play its game a little bit, right? Like, you can't play too many expensive spells because Modern is so fast. You have to interact in some way. So that's why you often see what look like sort of jammed in pass or Thoughtseize or whatever. You have to do something relatively interactive on turn one. And if you're willing to do that with a certain number of cards, then you can kind of do your other goofy thing, you know, like Niv-Mizzet. It plays all these interactive cards on two and three, and then you can play your like five mana dragon. So Modern asks you to pay a price, and when Modern is at its best, I think paying that price lets you do a wide variety of things. And when Modern is at its worst, I think it's when that price basically prevents you from exploring the format. I guess that's how I think of it.
I guess in my head, it's even kind of a literal puzzle too. Like I think if, as you're looking at like sort of like the puzzles you used to make with your grandma, right? So you have a kitchen table and it's like full of a bunch of puzzle pieces. And like after you've been at it for a little bit, you've got like, you know, the bottom right section kind of constructed and you've got like a little bit of the top left constructed or whatever. And you're really looking to fill around it and see what fits with those existing pieces. So like a lot of times you'll approach a deck and you're like, okay, I've got this particular synergy I want to use, or I've got a core. And like a great example to me is like the Utopia Sprawl Arbor Elf core, for example, and you slap a Kiora on it. And so now you've got like, you know, literally 20% of the puzzle built, and now you're just filling in stuff around that. And so to me, there's some aspect of just like literally you have a portion of what you need to build defined by either, you know, your own internal interest based on a particular card or synergy, or you can define it by the format, like Dave is saying, where like maybe your puzzle starts with like, hey, I know I need to start with, you know, some level of interaction. So my puzzle always starts with, you know, three Fatal Posts, four Thoughtseize or something. Or like if I'm white, four Path, the one Winds of Abandon or whatever, right? So you've always got a piece of your puzzle defined. And you're just trying to like fit what, you know, fit around that something to actually complete the picture of your deck. So I mean, that's a little bit in my head of what I was going for. And then the only other aspect of that is, where I was talking about Sudoku, is like kind of in Sudoku, you can get to a point where you're, if you put one thing in, something else breaks and you have to like make a whole bunch of trade-offs. And that also plays into the deck building for me. So it's really trying to like figure out the exact numbers and plugging something in and see what breaks. And sometimes you have to like work backwards to figure out what you have slots for and what you can actually fit in there from a combo perspective.
Yeah, right. What we called that when we were doing that, but not solving the puzzle, was the leaky bucket syndrome, where you try to solve the Sudoku puzzle, but whenever you try to do one thing, it like doesn't seem like it makes sense.
Yeah, you end up with the decks that just have like too much dissonance, right? There's too many separate things going on, and the whole thing kind of just falls apart.
Yeah, or the meta attacks your deck in too many different ways, and you can't make the deck strong enough to handle all the different directions.
So sticking with the puzzle analogy then, Rhett, how much of like the shape of the puzzle do you actually have on your mind? Because you said you try to fill it in around the pieces that you know. Does that mean you kind of imagine that, like, okay, I've got my one slot covered, for example. That's my turn one play is the discard spell. And then you kind of already know that you need just to fill in blank categories, like X number of two drops, X three drops or something.
Well, when you start discovering, like, casting cost, so to me, the casting cost fits far more into what Dave was saying. So to me, there's something very powerful about a pure visualization of your deck, where, as Dave was kind of eloquently describing, like, you need to understand the paths of your deck and understand what your plays should look like, and then do a mental exercise to figure out, like, hey, if my deck does its thing, whatever that may be in my mind, is that good enough? And so the actual curve, like how many ones, twos, or threes, like, doesn't necessarily matter, because depending on how you architect your deck, you can certainly skip slots. So, I mean, a great example is the 1-3 skip or the 2-4 skip are the two most classic skips.
What does that mean?
So, the 1-3 would be your classic, you know, I play a Lenoir Elf turn one, and then I play a 3-drop turn two, or in our case, Arbor Elf turn one, or Utopia Sprawl turn one, and then I hit a turn three, or a turn two Kiora, or another 3-drop, Knight of the Reliquary, what have you, whatever your personal preference may be there. And so I normally consider a 1-3 to be like a modern power level skip, and then the 2-4 is a standard, like, rampant growth into a 4-drop. You know, that those are more of like the standard power level skips, where you're going from like a growth spiral to a, you know, whatever your 4-drop of flavor is at the moment.
It's funny you say that, right? Because they said they won't print rampant growth in standard, and Llanowar Elves is legal in standard.
Well, not to mention there's what? Like, there's three tournament quality 2-drop skips, the Druids and the Growth Spiral, all of which seem tons of play, and Llanowar Elf, which is allegedly too powerful for standard.
And the 0-3D that lets you play an extra land.
Yeah, these cards, since our listeners may not be playing Standard week to week, so we're talking about Incubation Druid and Paradise Druid in Standard. They may be more familiar with the 0-3, the Arboreal Grazer. The Sloth is making some appearances in Modern, as Dave has been gleefully noting.
So, Rhett, when you're building a deck featuring this, the 1-3 skip or the 2-4 skip, do you then put in like less 2-drops or less 3-drops to correspond with that?
Yeah, certainly. So, I mean, the logical extreme of that is you can even void out the slot. So at some point between 8 and 12, 1-drops, like if I'm trying to do the 1-3 skip, so like in Modern, if I've got 4 Utopia Sprawl, 4 Arbor Elf, and then 4 Noble Hierarch, I'll just consider dropping the 2-slot completely. And so for me, that number is 8 to 12, usually at like 10-ish, I'll start considering just dropping an entire slot. And I find the 1-3 to be the biggest one to plan around. The 2-4 skip is also kind of interesting. So in standard, it's depending if you can actually get a legitimate amount of 2-drop accelerators, then it's very legitimate to drop the 3-slot, because then a lot of the 2-drop accelerators will let you do 2-drop accelerant on turn 2 and then double 2-drop accelerant on turn 3 into whatever kind of shenanigans you want to pull.
So I think that makes a lot of sense for how to conceptualize the shape of the deck you're going for and where you're going to concentrate, you know, your points in the curve, that sort of thing. What about sort of finishing the deck? Is there anything that you can point to that you sort of typically do to, like, get the list sort of ready to play? Like, for example, let's say you find that you have 6 to 10 slots and you're not quite sure what they should be. Like, what do you do with those slots? Or do you try to just go harder on the things your deck is already doing? Do you try to sort of round it out with some miscellaneous coverage?
I always find the last slots in the deck for me are usually the interactive things that Dave was mentioning earlier. So the last slots for me are very often where I'm splicing in, like, how many Path of Exiles can actually fit in this, or how much black discard can I really support? I mean, can I? And so those interactive pieces for me kind of fill things out. And normally, in Modern at least, I'll try to have 6 to 8 pieces of interaction. So that's usually my last 6 to 8. And if I get a little over-exuberant in terms of, like, filling out a combo and I don't end up with enough slots, then it's trying to trim the sails in the combo to get back to that point. The only other interesting note there is, quite often, if I have a deck that I'm, like, satisfied with, I've got my win conditions, I've got my combo pieces if I need them, I've got the interaction if I need it. I think it's always legitimate, especially in Modern where colors can be a little bit free, to stick in the filtering stuff. So then you're talking about, like, you know, either cantrip or shrinking the deck. I think it you can always take a long, hard look at the bobble to shrink your deck and give you extra information. And then in more severe cases where you're really trying to shrink your deck, you can use the Black Cycler, Street Wraith. But for me, usually, it's rounding out the actual interaction.
That's so interesting, because for me, personally, I really struggle with having too many cards I want to put into a deck, because I just start brainstorming word association, kind of card association. Like, oh, what about this? What about this? Like, this works with that. That works with that. And I end up with just, like, far too many cards to put in a deck, and I rarely have any empty slots where I'm just like, oh, maybe I should use deck thinning. But maybe that's something that I can improve on as a brewer, where if I just sort of start with the known pieces that either I think are powerful or that I want to learn about, I can maybe start the filling out that portion of the puzzle, as it were, and then see if I can sort of close it off with cards like you're talking about, like the bubble or the cantrips, to sort of find the powerful thing more frequently and more consistently.
And as an extra add-on to that, you have to make sure that your plan A, you know, matches up reasonably well with other plan A's. You know, one of the things we're seeing right now is the only really powerful linear effects can match up with Hogak, right? So it doesn't matter how powerful your turn 5 auto win is, you know, you'll often be dead by then. So you have to, you know, be able to race or disrupt the sort of linear strategies that might be faster than you. So that's why you see Poison or the Devoted Druid combo. They have a fundamental turn which can often be faster than even Hogak.
So I know that, Red, you have early morning tomorrow, so I don't want to keep you too long here. Let me just put the question to you guys for sort of a final word on this sort of preliminary dive into the fundamentals of brewing. What would you sort of want to leave a brewer or would-be brewer with? If there's any advice you want to give them, someone who maybe has an idea for a deck that, you know, they would like to try out their brew, but they are not quite sure yet how to proceed.
To me, the most fundamental thing in building a deck is visualizing. Have a plan, know what your deck wants to do, visualize what that looks like over the first 4 or 5 turns with Goldfish in your head. And then once you have that, once you know what your first few turns are going to look like, then it's just trying to get yourself into a winning game state. And so to me, it's always visualizing and mental goldfishing is probably the most important skill to learn in terms of building decks.
Yeah, and I'd say as part of that visualization, start with 4 ofs as it's just a deck building exercise for everything. So, you know, 4x of, like when Damon talks about AB combos, 4x of part A, if you have a replicate ability of that, 4x of the second part, 4x of part B, 4x of the second part. You can get cute with all these other varieties, but a lot of times the list that we're seeing, or even that I start to cook up, you get a little too cute. Oh, do I really need that? Do I really need that? What if this card would be kind of fun? Start with the basics of that, and like Red says, plan out your first 4 or 5 turns. If no one's doing anything, how smoothly can all this happen? How easy can you find the pieces that make your deck kind of do what you want it to do? And from there, you can prune, but I think you want to start out. It's hard to be right when you're cutting cards. It's much easier if you're going for consistency to have the maximum amount.
Damon, any final questions?
I think that we kind of touched on it. It's just like, how do you handle the, like, how do I put all these awesome cards in my deck problem that I also suffer from?
The Cave Dam problem, the Damon problem.
Yeah.
So how do you guys handle that? Or maybe they don't even struggle with that problem.
Well, I did. I feel like that is normally, like, before I send you guys a list, I end up with a huge list of cards. But then, yeah, my literal function is like, all right, turn 1, what do I want to do? This or this? Well, this seems a little better. Okay. So do I really even need the second effect because the generic effect is so powerful? Or is this enough? And I just ruthlessly, you know, use that thought process. Now, a lot of times you guys will see me include 1-ofs that I don't necessarily believe in, just as a way to kind of spark you guys. It's like, oh, here's a different option at 2 or 3 or 1. And then sometimes you guys say, oh, I think that's way better than maybe what you consider to be your primary plan. So I don't necessarily present what I consider to be like a finished placeholder, because I want to bounce a bunch of ideas off you. And it's always you guys come at it from a different angle I never considered, or you know, consider cards stronger or weaker than I do. So in that sense, I kind of break my own rule, but only for sort of discussion purposes.
Rhett, what about you?
I guess just over the years so I've literally been brewing Magic decks for over 2 decades. Like it is fairly natural for me to find like the right amount of cards for a deck, and I don't actually struggle nearly as much as I used to with having too many cards. It just, I don't know, it just kind of works, and that must just be some weird heuristic I've developed over the years.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a cleaner way to do it, because your decks do tend to crush whatever I've brought to the table. So it's discipline and experience, something we can all strive for. I think we'll leave it at that for this version of the Brewers Roundtable. Rhett, thank you so much for joining us and letting us pick your brain a little bit.
No problem.
Okay, so I think that will do it for this edition of Faithless Brewing. We have a GP to play, so we will be back next week with all the details on how that turned out. But in the meantime, we will see you all next week.
Yeah, see you guys on the other side of a fun Niv-Mizzet weekend.
I'm excited for this.
Oh, me too.
Take care, guys.
Peace.
That'll do it for episode 15 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. Faithless Brewing is a listener-supported podcast. We depend on brewers like you to help us spread the word, grow, and improve the show. If you like what you heard on today's show, have feedback for us, or just want to talk brews, we want to hear from you. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG, email us faithlessbrewing@gmail.com, or find us on Reddit at r/modernmagic. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.